As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC, brought to you by The Athletic. My name is John, with me is Jason.
Good evening.
And good evening, Michael.
Good evening. Putting the W back in Watford, it's Mike. Hello.
Yes, because Watford have won 2-0 at home to Huddersfield Town. And 4 weeks ago, we lost away at Huddersfield 2-0. And, well, we had a change of manager. And I suppose in many ways, this podcast, we're going to sort of compare and see where Watford are after just four games under Cisco. Let's start, though. I want to know, lads, who for you was the key player in that performance? Jason, who was the key player for you?
Maybe an obvious one, but I'm going to say Tom Cleverley. Just from the point of view of chasing down that back pass, the look of determination on his face and sort of that Tom Cleverley engine that we know he's got went into overdrive.
Is that what it was, Jace? It was the look in his eye that froze the goalkeeper to his line.
Yeah, I think it must have been, because there's no other explanation as to why the keeper just sort of stood back and waited. It was bizarre, wasn't it? Just felt up until that point we just lacked a bit of punch up front, didn't we? And I think we were either playing patient football that was allowing Huddersfield to get men back, or we were sort of, if we did try to up the tempo and get it up front early, those balls weren't very accurate and so Huddersfield was sweeping those up, and we needed something to happen to change the game. And it was Tom chasing that down, getting the goal, and then all of a sudden we looked comfortable. We seemed a lot more composed. Our passes were starting to stitch together a lot better. We were sort of in control of the game from that point on, with that bit of confidence that the goal gave us. So yeah, for me, for that moment, Tom Cleverley.
Yeah, I mean, it was the 54th minute, and Mike, that first half and second half were very, very different.
Yeah, I mean, the first half was a real difficult watch. Actually, it just felt very fractious from the start straight away. I mean, one thing I did notice, and we'll talk about him, but Batman was very, very vocal. But apart from that, There was lots of vocality. Is vocality a word? John, you're a teacher. Let's go with it.
Let's go with it. I love it.
I'm in one of those moves.
Yeah.
There were lots of back chat from the Watford players to the ref. Early on, Troy Deeney did really well to earn possession and played Saar in. He felt he got a tug and he just stopped. He wasn't playing for the whistle. It was all very stop-start. It felt very irritable. And as Jason just said there, nothing was really sticking. The passes were misplaced. There was a bit
and
of
it wasn't like Huddersfield were trying to play that way to make us uncomfortable.
Absolutely not.
I couldn't tell you what it was.
It was just something in the air, wasn't there? And you know, I think you're right to mention Huddersfield and the lack of impact they had on the game. I mean, that was a very, very bare bones Huddersfield side. They were missing a lot of players. So that was a skeleton side, if you like. It was a long way from their first 11. So this, you know, going to the ground, it felt like an opportunity, or just before kickoff, it felt like an opportunity for Watford, who we've said time and time again are looking to kickstart their season. And looking at the Watford side that was named, you know, that would be a Watford side that could be comfortably be named in the Premier League. So it felt like an opportunity against a team that was shorn of a lot of their better players, and it just didn't click for whatever reason. Like I say, they were sniping at the ref. There was a lot of arguing at the ref, a lot of mention on the WhatsApp group of some of the fruity language that was heard over the Hornet Hive feed on TV. And it was like that. And there was misplaced passes. You know, Troost Ekong tried to get a few balls going, and they were misplayed. So the balls were being fizzed into feet too hard, and it was a dog's dinner of a first half, really.
But we got through it.
We did, and I think that's fair to say. And I think I was a bit glib at half time, sort of said, and made that exact point that it wasn't a great first half. And a couple of people rightly pulled me up on it and said, look, Huddersfield haven't really laid a glove on Watford at all. Batman didn't have a save to make. So, you know, let's not get too snippy about it. And I think that's fair. But it did feel like it was going to take something bizarre, which the first goal was, which Jason's explained already, to break the deadlock. And then once the deadlock was broken, then it felt like Watford finally got going. They found their mojo.
Yeah, and go on, Mike. What about you? Jason said Tiklev was his key player. Who was your key player?
Well, I think he's been my player of the season so far, and it's Kiko Femenia. And I just think in every game he plays, he tends to look a cut above. He looks. I said that entire first 11 could be a Premier League side, and but he is the one that's consistently looked like a Premier League player, a cut above. You know, he looks like he's got that little extra bit of time on the ball. He's looking to do something with it. He looks calm, composed and assured. And of course, for the second goal, we saw what we love about him so much, a lovely run.
Because you know what? I had literally just thought, you know what? I don't feel like I've seen Tiki. I don't know. I know he's there and he's playing, but I haven't, you know, that thing where you notice and you remember players in some games. And sometimes that's great because they're doing their job. No nonsense, they're getting on with it. I thought, I don't really notice Kiko much in this game. The next minute, there you go, down the wing, controls the ball the wrong side of the Huddersfield player, into the box, across it goes, and a goal for Pedro.
Lovely to watch, but it's sort of frustrating as well, because you think, wow, it's really not that hard, guys, is it? Because as much as, you know, as I just said, we laboured for the first half and just couldn't click at all. And then once that goal went in, the shackles came off, and it just felt like they warmed up. They sort of they came out of hibernation. They found their mojo, and yeah, kick-started by Kiko down the right. Lovely ball in. I mean, we don't want to talk about him again too much, but Saar mishit his shot, which allowed Pedro to slot home. So it's a lovely goal, and you know Watford did enjoy a period of quite enjoyable dominance after Cleverley did break the deadlock. But the question you do question yourself: oh, where is this Watford? Where was this Watford side for the first 45 minutes? But yeah, I think I'll answer your question directly. I thought Kiko, he consistently looks like one of the best players on the pitch, and I often when I'm sat there watching it and. All too often it's been quite turgid, quite a difficult watch this season, and you do think, where would we be without Kiko this year? He really has been a shining beacon of Premier League quality.
Jason, on the end of that cross that scored the second goal, of course, as we know, was João Pedro. And, you know, he had, started up front with Deeney, and that goal just shows that he was just a step ahead of Mr. Deeney to get on the end of that goal. And he did a lot of running, maybe enough for both of them. Is he, you know, part of that continuation of his development we've seen this year? He's been out for a while, played last week, but he's slowly now developing, isn't he?
He is, yeah. And you used the word partnership again. I'm not sure I saw a partnership again today between those two. It's like Troy was doing his thing, Zhao was doing his thing. I think at the start, okay, perhaps I'm being a bit harsh, because at the start, it looked like Zhao was the more advanced. Deeney was dropping back, but then that didn't seem to last too long. And in the end, it seems to be Zhao that was sort of dropping deep to come and get the ball a lot more and sort of being a lot more mobile, as you'd probably expect. But again, you say it's part of his development. I think we were seeing this from him right at the start of the season as well. We'd getting about the pitch. And again, that strength was on show today. And if you're talking about the goal, I think he started that move as well, didn't he? Was it him that played the ball out wide to Kiko in the first place, and then he's made that run to get onto the cross at the back post, which probably helps being a late run, probably hard for a striker to be picked up, but it just shows the benefit of that mobility, of that sort of moving between the lines. I thought one of the things I did notice today that I thought was better than it has been this season was some of the movement when we were on the ball. I was actually starting to see, perhaps more in midfield actually, when the defenders had the ball, you'd start to see midfielders moving around and just sort of creating space. And as the game wore on, I thought that the space has got more and more. And if you've got someone like Zhao dropping deep to get the ball, get involved in the play, let the guys out wide do their stuff, because, again, under Šiško, we seem to be making good use of the wide players, perhaps less so in the first half, better in the second half. But then Zhao's made that run, that late run. No one's picked him up, and that means he can sort of ghost in at the back post and he's got an easy finish for the goal.
One thing I did pick up on, and that was João Pedro giving Ismaïla Sarr a massive verbal volley right before the final whistle. He really got stuck into him. I'm not quite sure what it was about, and it looked like they were intent on sorting it out after the final whistle as well. They both sort of headed down to the tunnel to deal with that. So that was interesting.
Mike, the thing, so the surprise, the moment when the teams came out at 2 o'clock was seeing the fact that Hughes and Zinchenogle didn't start, because they're the players we want to see what Zinchenogle can do. We want to see, can Hughes do what he can do? And we have been hoping he was going to bring to the Watford team. They came on late on. Chalabar went off. Hughes came on in about the 69th minute. What did you see from those two, particularly Hughes? Did either make an impact on this performance, or was it just the fact that they came on when we were 2-0 up?
I think it's really easy, and we've said this before, that it's the player who isn't playing that can always make the difference, isn't it? And I think there's a bit of a danger of that with Will Hughes. He's had such rotten luck in terms of getting into the side this season for a whole host of reasons. And I believe he was poorly in the week and wasn't able to train, which is why he was on the bench today. And just another, you know, example of just him just having vile luck, really. But I thought when he came on, I just thought he made a big difference. I talked about Kiko earlier, but having that Premier League sort of impact, just looking composed on the ball. Well, I think Will Hughes popped up everywhere, and he looks sort of a lot more dynamic. There's a lot more cut and thrust about him than there is in the midfield without him. And I think key to Watford's success, or any success that Watford are going to have for the rest of the season, is going to be with Will Hughes. I think with Etienne Capoue moving on, there's a lot of work to be done in that midfield, and I think Will Hughes is the man best equipped to do it. I just pray that he has he's able to have a good run of games, because Watford are really going to need him. I thought he looked good when he came on. Admittedly, you know, Watford were ahead by then, and you could argue that the life was out of Huddersfield. There wasn't really much danger of them getting back into the game. But nonetheless, what we're looking for in this Watford side is a spark, isn't it? Something that drives us forward. And I think that's what João Pedro was the really one of the, him and Kiko were the only ones really that were showing any glimpses of sort of prowess and real sort of guile and skill to move us forward. Whereas Will Hughes is a bit more grab it by the scruff of the neck and make it happen. So I think he's going to be absolutely vital for Watford. We just need to keep him, whatever we do, we need someone to look after him, pray for him, whatever, wrap him in cotton wool, whatever. Just keep him safe, keep him warm, keep him fed, keep him watered, because I think he's going to be really important. I think he looks important. He looks like the part. He looks like he can make a difference for me as soon as he comes on.
I know, word with my mum, maybe he can become part of her bubble. look after him. Jason, the thing we've got used to maybe a little bit this year is defence, because it was Watford 2, Huddersfield 0. And again, defensively, I know they weren't really pushing us. I know they weren't really challenging us. They weren't asking questions, but a great performance from our defence.
Yes, was very good today. As I say, clean sheet, solid. Backman had pretty much nothing to do all game. And I think there was one save late on from one of the youngsters that came on for Huddersfield. Great to see these guys who've sort of come in new to the squad. Sierra Alto's only just got his run of games, did very well. Thought slightly unlucky to get booked when he did.
Yeah, very.
And Trusty Kong is the master of the shoulder to shoulder challenge. He just does it so well. It's fun, isn't it? It's so effective. Sometimes you get a bit worried as he sort of goes in and sort of looks like he's going to play the player rather than the ball, but just seems to do such a good job of it. And he would have had a couple of tricky sort of opponents today. Fraser Campbell's got a bit of pace on him, and then Danny Ward came on, who's a decent, experienced Championship striker. And he seemed to handle those two reasonably effectively and without fuss. And I think I've said it before, if you've got defenders that can deal with strikers with no fuss, then you're onto a winner there.
There was a lovely moment towards the end of the game where the Huddersfield got away down. This was very, very late on, probably post 90 minutes. One of the Huddersfield players got in down the left. Trusty Kong sort of tracked him and effectively harried him until the guy put the ball out for a goal kick. So this is what you were talking about really there, Jace, just sort of marshalled him perfectly in a dangerous area and basically won a goal kick. And Sir Alta was right over on the left-hand side, but he ran over and gave Trusty Kong a massive sort of chest bump just to say, yeah, awesome, well done, mate. And just to see that sort of, that connection there between them, because I think that's been lacking a little bit. You wonder about this team sort of. There hasn't been much joy emanating from it. So just to see that little sort of thing there was really encouraging. And I thought, yeah, that speaks volumes about how they're feeling back there. They've done really well. And Sir Alta, I think, again, having come into the team, hasn't looked back at all. He's looked absolutely imperious, hasn't he? And just, I really enjoyed that moment, just like them enjoying a job well done. I thought, yeah, fair play. Even though you haven't been stretched massively, just to sort of recognise each other is good. And just to see the smiles on Pedro's face as well after the goal. It's little things like that I think we can take heart of. Spitz, talking about taking heart, just seen a stat come through from John Sinclair on Twitter. After 23 games, this is still our best start to a championship season during the Pozzo era. So despite it not being the most amazing performance, certainly not feeling like the most amazing season so far, decent signs perhaps.
One of the things that does bode well for the future games was the way we finished today, I thought, because we finished on the front foot rather than sit back and defend a 2-0 lead. We actually kept control of the game. We kept the momentum. We were looking to try and get a third without being sort of gung-ho on the attacking front. It was sensible but controlling football, and we were still being positive. And I know in the past we've sort of talked about how quickly we can be negative and sit back and try and soak things up. We didn't do that today. So I think if we can continue in that vein for the next few games, that will be a positive. And I look forward to the side being 2-0 up in every game for the rest of the season and playing that way for the last 15, 20 minutes. That's positivity for you.
Well, the true test, of course, is the games that are to come. You know, we've got Barnsley in the week, Stoke, then Millwall, then QPR, Mike. And so the question I have is, the team that we saw out there, even with the level of substitutes we were putting on, we were playing Huddersfield, and a weakened Huddersfield. Do you think we've got what it takes to, you know, really take a game to one of the top sides and guarantee almost a good performance and the right results against teams that we're meant to get those results against?
We can't guarantee a performance because we haven't really had anything approaching a complete performance all season. And during the first half, I must admit to getting a little bit grumpy and thinking, oh, the thought of this Watford side is always so much better than the reality of it. And again, I'm looking at the team sheet now, and the side we put out is on paper is tremendous, and there's strength on the bench as well. But they just made too much like hard work of it in the first half. So nothing can be guaranteed, but absolutely this side can do it. They can take it. You know, the teams you mentioned there have got Barnsley next, and this is absolutely no disrespect to Barnsley. In the same division, they've beaten us this season. But that they should hold no fear for this Watford side. There is talent throughout it. And I know we as a fan base have scoffed at that sort of ongoing. It's almost become a bit of a sort of meme, hasn't it? A bit of a joke that Watford best squad in the Championship. But take a minute to look at the side and the squad that was available to us today. It is strong and there is talent there. They haven't solved the question yet. And Jason touched on it in terms of Troy and Pedro not quite firing, not quite working as a partnership. You know, Troy as well, you know, that challenge in the first half, perhaps lucky it was just a yellow card, that showed his frustration. So things not quite going right. But again, you know, when Troy came off, very, very vocal, very, very, he was cheering on the rest of the team, lots of advice for Andre Gray, lots of, you know, very vocal. So playing his part, but it's just not quite clicking, is it? And that they need to solve still the issue in the final third. All too often in the first half, our problems came because we were trying to hit long balls that weren't finding their target or were misplaced or the movement wasn't quite right. And it did take, let's be honest about it, let's not get carried away. It took the goalkeeper switching off for Watford to find a way into the game that, you know, we've spoken at length that it was a weakened Huddersfield side, the Huddersfield side that wouldn't have expected to challenge really Watford this afternoon. And then it did take a mistake for us to get into it. So there is still work for this side to do, but absolutely they can. We should be going into every game confident. And I think, you know, I don't think Zinchenko Nagel had the impact that when he came on that he would have liked. He took a while to warm up, I think, and his performance against Manchester United was a little bit more impressive. But we've got him to come in. We've got Will Hughes to come into the fold. So there is talent. There is attacking options. There are people that can potentially unlock our issue up front. But it does have to happen soon, and they have to work it out. And that's when it comes down to the head coach and his team of coaches. You know, a lot of people have been critical, saying, "Oh, he's just a yes man. He's just there to deal with the side that's delivered to him." And well, yes, he is. That's the role of the head coach at Watford. He doesn't have a really much of a say in signings. He has to mould what's given to him into a winning side, and that is now his job. Just has to find the winning formula. And It still looks elusive, but, you know, with Barnsley on Tuesday, we should go into that game with confidence. We have to. We really, really have to. And I said it in the podcast in the week, it will either click and we'll do well, or it won't and we won't. And we got a bit of fortune today, but they go into work on whenever it is, Sunday or Monday, off the back of a win. They have to turn that win into momentum.
We've talked about one man quite a bit on this podcast in the last few episodes, but not today so far. He did get himself 20 minutes on the pitch, didn't necessarily do much. Andre Gray, and yeah, we've talked about him quite a lot, and we need some help. We need some input. Mike's surname is Parkin. He has a son called Arlo, and this is our feature, Michael Parkinson.
Gives me great pleasure to welcome once again to Michael Parkinson. It's Arlo. Arlo, how are you doing?
Good.
2021, how's it treating you so far?
Fabulous.
Fabulous. Glad to hear it. Bit of positivity. Now, someone who needs a bit of positivity is Andre Gray. Really struggling at the moment. Hasn't scored for a while. Came on as a substitute against Huddersfield. Didn't really make an impact. Arlo, you've been captain for your team. You're quite good at sort of rabble-rousing and getting people going. What would you say to Andre Gray just to give him a little bit more confidence?
Keep going, never give up and try your best. If your best isn't good, like, if your best isn't enough to make us win, I just know that you tried your best and you worked hard.
Lovely. There you go, Andre. Arlo has spoken. Arlo, thanks so much for joining us. I hope your day, your week, your year continues to be fabulous. Thank you so much.
Toodaloo.
Part of the Athletic Podcast Network. This is From the Rookery End.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
This episode is supported by Season 3 of FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League 2 after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher division. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenges and rise again into League 1? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
If you haven't subscribed to The Athletic yet, then we've got a deal for you as a listener to From the Rookery End. Half price is what we'll do for you this month. Only $3.99. All you have to do is go to theathletic.com/rookeryend, and there you get the what is a now traditional. We all know The Athletic for, especially the stuff that we talked to Adam about, the long-form journalism, the original reporting, and the in-depth analysis of the world of sport. But we've had our own little go at a bit of in-depth looking at something, Mike. You spoke to Marvin Sordell this week, and you're going to hear the interview in a minute. Where did this start from? For me, it comes from our chats in the WhatsApp group, you know, between us all, and everything that's been going on Twitter recently about fans questioning the commitment and the motivation of some of the players that are currently pulling on the Watford shirt.
It came from the week before last, really, and it was in the fallout, following the fallout of the Swansea game, where obviously the Swansea striker celebrated in front of Ben Foster's GoPro, and Ben Foster tweeted about whether he should include that celebration in the video. And I think the light-hearted nature of the tweet sort of upset some Watford supporters, and you can understand that. They're feeling raw after losing the game. Troy Deeney's working for TalkSport on the Monday doing his radio stuff, and I think the week that followed that, it all felt incredibly short-tempered, irritable, and it felt like for the first time in a long time, the entire Watford fan base was really just frustrated, and it all felt like it boiled over. And I think that sort of speaks a little bit of frustrations as to Watford and the situation they find themselves in, and I think it speaks to the situation that we all find ourselves in. It's a very difficult situation. You know, the worldwide situation at the moment is problematic for us all, and everyone is struggling. And it just felt it all came to a head. But I did think some of it was potentially a little bit unnecessary. You know, I think sometimes we forget that the guys that pull on the yellow shirt, ultimately our heroes, are still just blokes. They're human beings trying to do their best, and I think sometimes that gets missed.
And you know, we try and guess what's going on in their heads, and it's terribly hard. And you know, we've interviewed countless footballers and ex-footballers over the last 11 seasons of doing this podcast, and you know, it's always the former players, the retired players, those who have stepped away from the game, that will give you that little bit more insight into, you know, what players think and feel. And that's sort of why we got in touch with Marvin Sordell. He's retired early, and you know, he's moved on from football. But his achievements, you know, he pulled on a Watford shirt, which is what we all want to do, really. He played the Premier League. He represented England. He took part in the Olympics. And what he's doing now is even more admirable than what he did as a footballer.
Hugely. I'm in absolute awe of Marvin Sordell, because he went through a really difficult time, and I think it's well documented that the move to Bolton came at a difficult time for Watford. Then his time at Bolton was challenging for a whole host of reasons, and I think most Watford supporters know what Marvin went through. But what he did, he used those difficult experiences, and he recognised those difficult experiences and found a way to turn them round, so to turn them into positive experiences that he could then use to help others. And he's never been shy about speaking out and speaking up, but speaking up incredibly thoughtfully, powerfully and articulately. And for him to turn a tough time into something that is so impressive, as I've always found inspirational. And he took the time to talk to a number of Watford supporters on Twitter in that week where everyone were getting a little bit aerated, shall we say, and gave his side of the story, sort of explained what it's like for a footballer. And I think just what he's managed to do is hugely impressive, and it was a no-brainer to reach out to him, and luckily he was able to talk to us, and I found it enlightening, and I'm going to use the word again, but inspiring to speak to him. I think it's absolutely fantastic to talk to Marvin.
So here's Mike with his conversation he had with Marvin Sordell early this week.
Just look inside the mind of a striker, Marvin. What are the things that can go wrong when you're playing up top?
I think the biggest thing as a striker is overthinking. Especially when you've been in a team that's been relegated, as I have done many times, unfortunately. But the biggest thing is not really getting opportunities. And so when you do get the opportunity, you've been thinking about it for so long, and you maybe snatch at it and you don't take it, or it doesn't go as planned, and then you may think, oh, when's the next one going to come? And you overthink and you overthink and you overthink, and you might not get one for a couple of games. And as last season, you know, being down the bottom of the league, that's what happens. You know, you're not scoring goals, and which is one of the reasons why you're down the bottom of the league. And so you overthink these things, you get relegated, and that mentality kind of carries on.
Sure. You mentioned relegation. We can't get away from it, unfortunately. And I remember talking to someone, it was post-lockdown, and Watford's performances after lockdown were surprisingly poor from my point of view. And I was speaking to this guy, and he said, Mike, you have to remember that while you've been in lockdown and all the struggles you've gone through with your family and work and all that sort of stuff, these guys have had that too. And it gave me pause for thought. I thought, actually, yeah, I see these guys as footballers. And not necessarily, it's going to sound terrible, but not necessarily, I don't really think of the human element of it, their day-to-day life, the fact that they might have not been able to see their kids so much or so on and so forth. So those off-field issues that footballers have to deal with, Marvin, I think as supporters sometimes we're guilty of not perhaps giving them the attention or the space they deserve. What's your experience of being a footballer and having to deal with off-field issues?
Firstly, I think you raise a very interesting point, and it's not necessarily a fan's fault. I think at times, you know, even myself, you kind of think, how do these people not see it? But, you know, even when you kind of go down to the basic things in football where people are not even called by their first name, they're called by their surname. And straight away you think, well, that's not necessarily just who I am. You know, my friends call me Marv, and yet you're like, Sordell. And straight away, that kind of distances people from me as a person, and that human element kind of slips away slightly. And then you kind of take it up a notch, and you think, you know, football as an industry, as a game, is so overanalyzed. It's such a big business where the clubs are the big business and the players are the products, essentially. And I think sometimes that gets missed when you think about all of the other things that happen outside of football. And, you know, for me, when I was younger, I found that balance really difficult to understand, you know, because I, like every young player, was on social media, or every young person really even was on social media. You know, and at the time I had a lot of different interests, and, you know, as any person does, you share them with the world, you share them with your feed, and you talk about them, because that's what social media is for, really, to give more people a glimpse of your personality and who you are. And for me, that was a massive thing, because at the time I felt so close to Watford fans in particular. You know, there were many that I would say hi to all the time and have conversations with after the game. They'd speak to my mum, and my mum used to go on the supporters coach to away games. And she'd have conversations with him. It felt that close-knit, so it felt fine for me to then, as I moved on beyond Watford, to continue in the same kind of way and be very open about who I was, what I was interested in. But when you kind of got to those higher levels, I think what comes to mind always is that you're only here for football, and so you don't have the authority, or you shouldn't step outside of your lane, you know, whether it's talking about topics or whether it's having any sort of interests or other activities or hobbies you may be doing as well.
That sort of only here for football phrase is quite depressing, I guess, in a way, isn't it? Because, you know, I'm more about than just this podcast. You are more than just about football. And do you think there's an issue? We talked about the supporters side of thing, Marvin, and how we are often probably too quick to draw a conclusion or make a judgment. What about inside the game? Because I know when you moved to Bolton, there was a few issues, and there were a few public statements, weren't there, about your social media, wasn't there? And so do you think there's an issue within the game in terms of just the pressure and sort of how are people looked after in the game? And is it enough necessarily?
I'd say not. I mean, I think the game's moving forward. It's moving forward slowly, but I think it's definitely moving forward. And one of the things is around well-being, and, you know, I touch on well-being and mental health a lot. But, you know, it's one of the things I do for a living these days, is deliver talks and workshops in this subject. And I talk about the links between mental health and identity. And one of the biggest things that I struggled with was finding a real identity, because for me, all my identity was being a football player. And so you're allowing your identity to take charge of your emotions, essentially, because that's what we do on a daily basis. If your identity is I'm a father and I'm a happy father and I enjoy spending time with my family, I'm a family man, a lot of your sense of enjoyment and your emotion you're going to get from that identity and the things that surround your identity. And for me, one of the biggest problems was that my identity was football. Football was my safe space when I was a kid, and that was because it was my hobby. So it's my escape from the rest of the world, essentially. And for most people, that is the case who are football fans. It's their escape from the world. But people forget that for football players, this is their job, and your job cannot be your safe space. Your job cannot be your escape from your job. It doesn't make sense. And if you're relying on that to fulfill you in that capacity, then it's only going to end badly, essentially, because I wondered very much why I was struggling to separate the two. You know, I'd go home after maybe a bad training session or a bad match, and every little detail was just tearing me apart, and I couldn't separate that. I couldn't go home and just switch off and think about other things, and which is one of the reasons why I did go into having other hobbies and interests, because I thought I have to find a way to be able to separate my work from my life.
Because that's what strikes me as being difficult. You know, footballers are usually relatively, you know, young men, potentially inexperienced in the world. And somehow you're operating at such an elite level with all those pressures. And just how do you find that balance between committing, because obviously football's a team game as well, so you have to commit to your own sporting development, you have to commit to being there for your team as well, but how do you also balance that up with those commitments but also committing to yourself and your own, like you say, your mental health and well-being?
Yeah, I mean it's a big challenge, and a lot of football players do suffer from mental health problems, and you know, many kind of hide them and bottle them up in various ways, but it's something that is quite common. You know, I saw it in the change room, and even players who maybe don't necessarily think that themselves and think that they are struggling themselves, I've seen a lot of telltale signs that I was showing and portraying in earlier times in my life.
It's just difficult, right? Talk to me about perhaps what it's like in a dressing room. Would you feel, or do you think there's players who perhaps feel unable to share it? Because, you know, I think of a dressing room and I still think of it being very boisterous, very noisy, very sort of alpha male type thing. And I think we are getting better as people at sharing our feelings. But do you think the dressing room environment has changed much necessarily since you started to what it's like now?
It's definitely changed a lot. But, you know, to have that conversation in any capacity, in any space, is very difficult. And, you know, the change room is no different in that sense. And I don't think it's necessarily too different from a working environment in that sense. You wouldn't just open up in the middle of a meeting and say, "Oh, I need to say this. I'm really struggling, or I'm suffering with mental health issues or depression or whatever it may be," because you'd find that very daunting and very uncomfortable to do so. And football in the change room is very much like that. Most people it's a busy environment. It's a busy place, and there's a lot going on, and there isn't really, well, there aren't really slow periods of time to, I guess, take a step back and have that conversation. And some people may not be willing to listen, and some people may not understand it. So it's also understanding that environment. And some teams, I guess, you're lucky in some respects that some teams are better equipped and maybe closer knit to be able to have those types of conversations. Mm. You know, I had a conversation with when I did the Heads Up series with, and I was talking with Jurgen Klopp and Andy Robertson, and they were talking about how the fact that the club's been, the squad has been together, like the bulk of the squad have been together for about 3 years, and that makes a massive difference in them being able to have these conversations with each other, as well as the fact that they have a professional that is pretty much a part of the group as well.
You mentioned you work there, and you know you've got your own production company doing great work there. Someone who's sort of slightly less down that road so far, but he is making videos. I just want to touch on it quickly, more as a case study, Marvin, as opposed to the individual incident. But obviously Watford's Ben Foster at the moment, he's got his YouTube channel, and I think it's fairly well publicised. I think he's been honest that he has these things, that he has his cycling, he does the videos, and they're a way of sort of compartmentalizing his life and dealing with he sees the video thing as a sort of a hobby, I guess, and that's part of his way of dealing with life as a professional footballer, which is fraught and difficult for all the reasons we've discussed. I mean, obviously it came to a head, I think it was last week, when I think Watford supporters were feeling a little bit tetchy. Everyone's feeling a little bit tetchy at the moment because of lockdown and all the various restrictions and the worries about the future. And then Watford had lost. And I think perhaps a comment Ben Foster made was slightly misconstrued about whether he should include the celebration of an opposition striker. We all know that, you know, if I scored a goal in Ben Foster's net, the first thing I'm doing is pointing at that GoPro camera. And I'm sure you'd probably be the same. But do footballers have a responsibility to think about their outlets a little bit more? Or if it's something that they enjoy, should they just be allowed to do it?
I can see why some people have been unhappy with him doing that, or the way, I guess, he portrayed it on his social media. But in the end of the day, you know, football is a game that moves very, very quickly. And this is one thing that I mentioned as well, is that, you know, because people are maybe upset the fact that, you know, the team's lost, he's conceded a couple of goals, maybe he's made a mistake. I've actually not seen the goal, so I've not seen the goal that he's potentially made a mistake for, so I can't comment on that. But in the end of the day, football moves on, you know, and I understand that people can be quite sensitive to it, but I don't think they should be, because in the end of the day, football is entertainment. If you're not entertained, that is because you don't want to be entertained. If you're coming into football and you're wanting to watch football, you're wanting to partake in this industry and in whatever capacity that may be, but not be entertained, then why are you doing it to yourself?
Yeah, sure.
You know, football has changed a lot over the last 10 to 15 years, and social media has played a massive part in that. And we talk about modern day clubs, we talk about modern day players, and modern day fans are also a massive part of that. You know, I think even from my perspective as a fan, the way I talk about football now, because I'm very much probably still in between that state of being a player and a fan, but I'm very much a football fan, and I talk about football the same way a lot of other people do, but maybe from a different perspective because I have played the game as well.
Sure.
And so I think people need to, I guess, understand that, you know, in the end of the day, this is entertainment, and there are many different ways of entertaining people. And I think what Ben Foster's doing, I mean, in reality, you know, if Watford were winning every game, people would say, this is so great. This is brilliant. Like the insight that we're getting into a professional football player's career, someone of his stature that's played at his level, really getting it to the nitty gritty of, you know, what the day to day life of a professional football player is. Most people would be saying, this is such an amazing insight. Thank you for giving us this insight, because this is exactly what the platforms such as YouTube and the reason why social media exists, is to give people an insight.
Yeah, on that, Marvin, do you think that, and I'm really sorry, these feel like really difficult questions, and I feel like I'm putting you on the spot a little bit. I'm pretty sure you can handle it, though. So do you think, because I think I'm guilty of this, I put my hands up, and I certainly have been in the past, do you think footballers are held by supporters to a higher level of accountability than is perhaps fair, or than perhaps they would sort of give to themselves? I think the one that always sort of sticks in my throat a little bit is the loyalty thing. Oh, there's no loyalty in football anymore. Whereas, you know, if I came home and I was looking for a new job, and I got a new job that was secure, twice as much money, in a place I wanted to live, you know, I'd expect my friends to be really pleased with me, my parents to be pleased, and I would see that as a success. Where sometimes, you know, a player moves on and football supports, there's no loyalty anymore. And the reality is the player's gone on to earn more money, to be security, and to perhaps achieve more. So, again, just an example. But do you think there's a danger, and is that one of the downsides of being a footballer, that you're held to an unnecessarily high standard, perhaps?
At times, I think, yeah. And I think the reason I say that, because many people say, well, you know, why shouldn't they be held to account or whatever, because they have platforms, they're paid very well, etc. But, you know, at times the argument is players should be more down to earth. They should be more like players from the olden times. They should be, you know, they should be closer to fans and engage more and be more personable. And yet at times when those people, those personalities do come out and people are very honest and just themselves, they just get battered down. It's a very difficult question to answer, actually, because
I did warn you.
I think people should be able to be themselves, you know. And I look at the NBA as a great example for a sport that has massive, massive personalities. You know, people who are earning extortionate amount of monies, like, you know, it dwarfs what football players earn. And these are people at the highest levels, and they're still so in touch with their community and their people because their audiences allow them to bring their personalities to the table every day. Their audiences, the fans allow them to, the clubs allow them to be themselves all the time. And as much as people may say they want players to be themselves and be very honest, but will they allow that to happen? Will they allow them the space to be themselves and partake in these types of conversations? Because as I mentioned in the conversation I had with you know, a few people on Twitter, if I was a football player, I would have just been attacked for what I was saying, as opposed to actually being able to have a conversation.
It's interesting you mentioned the NBA, Marvin. What I really, really enjoy, well, one of the great things I like about American sport is that access. And you could argue that perhaps it crosses a line and players do become too much of a sort of publicly owned commodity, if you like. But, you know, the NFL, they're mic'd up and all that sort of stuff. And you get some incredible footage. Do you think perhaps opening the doors in, you know, there's locker room footage, isn't there, and I think that American sportsmen are certainly seeming able to find their voice a little bit quicker and a little bit better than perhaps over here, just because of the access is so free. I wonder if there was a more of a, you know, the barriers were less. Do you think that would help the sort of relationship between perhaps supporters and players, but more importantly, allowing the players to let that personality and that identity that you spoke about sort of form itself?
I definitely think so, because if you think about it, how can you personally relate to someone that isn't real? And how can you relate to a version of someone that you know is fabricated and you know is molded to look a specific way to appease people? If that's the case, then how are you supposed to relate to them? How are you supposed to warm to them and connect with that person? Because you just think, well, I don't believe what you're saying, so I'm not gonna, like, how can there be anything there?
That rings true as well at the moment. I think without supporters in the ground, they're not able to have even that. It's not a connection in the physical sense of the word, but sit there and watch their team play and get the reality, the reason for them being a supporter isn't there. And I think perhaps that's why things feel a little bit prickly at the moment, I think. And I think that's a really good point. One of the other things that I know you're interested in and you work around is helping players transition and perhaps plan for what might happen after football. And, you know, there's an increasing route from playing football into perhaps the media. There's more and more roles, you know, live reporting and Sky Sports News, all that sort of stuff. How difficult can it be to get prepared when you're playing?
It's very difficult. Just going off the conversation that we're currently having, it shows how difficult it is, because with players having interest outside of the game, there's always going to be barriers. You know, if I was playing at a Premier League team right now and you know, perhaps my form wasn't great and I was a filmmaker, people would have a lot of problems with that. You know, imagine now, you know, I can't even think of a player who's on or off, in or out of form, but imagine now someone was not playing well and they're doing this. You know, you look at what Ben Foster's trying to do with, you know, the next stage of his career. He's trying to build a platform to enable him to step over to another side and, you know, transition quite smoothly. And that's coming with a barrier. So it's very difficult to do. And, you know, one of the things I think that's quite unfair is that, you know, for football players, they, you know, they would have spent years and years and years prepping, essentially, to become professional football players. Relatively, you don't just turn up at 18 and say, right, I'm going to be a professional now. You start 5, 6, 7, 8, training, practicing, playing games, doing everything you can to learn, improve and hone your craft so that one day you can become a professional and you can exceed and do well in this industry. And when you want to then go from one industry to another, it's ridiculous, you know, quite frankly, to suggest that someone should just one day just say, right, today that's it, I'm finishing this industry, I'm going to start in another industry. And, you know, you may think, well, some of these players are earning £100,000 a week, but what about the ones that aren't? What about the ones that maybe are earning £500 a week, or on average throughout their career they're earning £1,500 a week? And it's still good money, but when you look at over a period of time, at some point anyway, they're gonna have to work. And beyond that, you know, even if you have all the money in the world, if you have no purpose and you have nothing to wake up for every day, then what are you doing?
You're obviously doing a great job of that transition. I think you retired, what was it, 2 years ago? Well, 2019, wasn't it, you retired?
Yeah.
And I think you realised, didn't you, it certainly appeared to me that you wanted to do something else, and you realised what you wanted that to be and what you wanted to stand up for and advocate for, and which was admirable.
Thank you.
Did you find that people, that even though it was just clearly such a thing that you were passionate about, that was so important and worthwhile, did you feel perhaps that people, was there any negativity, any pushback to it?
After I'd retired?
Well, I don't know, because it felt to me that you knew what you wanted to do quite early. So, yeah, I guess it, as the transition happened, I suppose.
I think after I'd retired, it was pretty easy, to be mm-hmm. honest, in that sense that people were, you know, happy for the fact that I knew what I wanted to do and were very supportive in, you know, multiple industries, you know, media, in film, in television, in the mental health space. You know, I've very lucky that I've been able to open up a network of people that I can have great conversations with, I can get great advice from and just lean on for support as well. And I think that's invaluable, really. And I think that's something that, outside of the football industry anyway, that is very much the case. You know, being a football player going into another industry, it intrigues a lot of people. Mm. So they're interested to learn about how you can cross that bridge and also why you're crossing that bridge.
Yeah, one of the strands that we mentioned is the production side of things with the video, and you mentioned Jurgen Klopp that you've worked with. Since you've come out of the game but stayed in it sort of from the other side, what would you say your main takeaways have been looking from the outside in about football in the last couple of years?
When I look now and I look back at particularly players, you know, I very much think they have no idea what their worth is. Mm. And I think that probably comes from the fact that on the whole they're told that they only need to focus on football and pretty much they just need to play and shut up. You know, that's what players are pretty much told on the whole, and they have no idea the strength of their brands, their industry expertise and knowledge, which something that I'm finding out is that it's completely invaluable. That's something massively that I've learned and understood over the past year and a half. And also that fans have so much power that they don't even realise in cheering on fans, but in terms of what actions clubs make, what sponsors do and what brands align with the club, very much comes from the fans. And I don't think fans also realise how much power they have in the game.
They can make or break almost. And just let's put your boots back on then, quickly, Marvin. Thank you for sticking with us and taking up a lot of your time here. But when would you say you were most happy and content as a footballer, and what do you think it was that made it like that?
I mean, it was definitely my time at Watford, and what made it like that is because of the feel, and that came from the fans, the people at the club and the players I was playing with. You know, I came up through the academy with a lot of people that I would call friends and who are still friends now. And that, I guess, maybe made me not realise how big an industry football was, how big a league the Championship was, how big a club, how big it was to play for a club like Watford as well. And it's strange to look back and think, you know, where I was then and kind of the journey I went on, because everything was so different when I left.
Yeah. not in a great way. Are you able to for those that aren't aware, can you sum up your departure from Watford?
chaotic, in a word, I would say.
Because it was under the chairman that shall, or the owner that shall not be named. We don't need to.
The infamous.
Yeah, but people will know straight away who we mean. But yeah, you went to Bolton, didn't you? And it was on a Watford were playing, weren't they? What was the sort of chronology of it, of events that day?
So we had Millwall away that day. It was a Tuesday night game, and we were in a hotel actually. And so, you know, just as normal, I'm preparing for the game because I didn't think anything was going to be happening. And then I got a call from my agent asking if I wanted to go to Cardiff, and I think they were top of the league at the time, and I was a little bit hesitant, really. I wasn't really sure if I'd wanted to do it, and waited a few hours, and I said, well, you know, if that's the case, if you know, I'm going to be sold, and then okay, you know, because, you know, one of the things that I was reminded of is that the club needed to sell a player in that window, and or in the summer, to basically, you know, stay afloat.
Yeah.
Because I think that was pretty much the case on a year-by-year basis at the club at the time. And then ended up going on the bus with the team to the game. I was pulled out of the squad, which I didn't actually... So even when I've said that, potentially, yes, to Cardiff, I still expected to play. I didn't expect that to go through.
Right.
And then I was pulled out of the team by the infamous owner at the time. Went to the stadium with the team, and then got a call while I was standing in a tunnel waiting to be picked up, and asked if I'd like to go to Bolton, and they were in the Premier League at the time, and I said, well, yeah, if it's between Bolton and Cardiff, you know, then it's a no-brainer, really. An opportunity to play in the Premier League is, you know, no-brainer. And so that was it, and I went to the Watford Stadium. I was picked up, driven to the Watford Stadium, and literally with maybe an hour or so to spare, I had to sign a couple of documents to basically extend the deadline.
Sure.
I think the deadline was like 11 o'clock or something. And then ended up signing for Bolton about 2 a.m, I think it was.
Wow. So we talked about pressure a lot and how you deal with it. Straight away, you can tell there. So you were made aware that selling playing staff was important for the continued, well, existence, really, of the club. Did you feel a sort of weight on your shoulders about that? So, like, look, really, I have to move if Watford are going to survive. If I don't go, then they're going to struggle. And then, you know, at 2 o'clock in the morning, you're a £3 million Premier League player all of a sudden. That's hard to both those things are hard to process. And just on that, we, you know, Ismaïla Sarr is a player that Watford supporters are talking about a lot at the moment. And the thing that you can't avoid is the big price tag. So does that play on a player's mind, that the amount that has been paid for them?
I mean, it does when you're consistently reminded of it.
Yeah, geez.
So yeah, and I think one of the biggest things is that people often forget how young these guys are as well. You know, when I moved to Bolton, I was 20, and you know, I was a kid. You know, 20 years old is a kid, really. I've not, at that time, I'd lived on my own for 6 months, and you know, all of a sudden, I was moving to the other side of the country, and on a moment's notice, you know, not really understanding what I was going to be in for, the dynamic and of the new place that I was going to be in, and I didn't really have time to do any research or understand. And you know, that's why the January transfer window is obviously difficult, and deadline day in particular is probably the worst time for a player to move ever.
Really pleased as Watford supporters and as a Watford podcast that your happy memories are from Vicarage Road from your playing career. But you mentioned the academy pathway, and that was something that at the time we were doing the podcast when you were in the team, and we were delighted to see guys like yourself coming through the academy and playing well, doing well, earning your moves, because it felt like the club was delivering. It was doing something. It was taking youngsters, local people, and bettering them and setting them on a pathway, and we took a lot of pride in that. And over the last sort of 5 or 10 years or so, I suppose that has diminished a little bit for obvious reasons. When you get into the Premier League, it's more difficult. But what is that journey like from, you know, academy through to first team? And if you could give some advice to Marvin Sordell as he started his footballing journey, what would it be?
For a start, that process and that journey is just an exciting one, really. I think particularly for Watford, being at Watford at the time, pathway to the first team was so clear. It was right there. You know, you'd get to train with the first team on a regular basis whilst in the youth team. You'd be exposed to it, you know, in and around the dressing room and the environment. So it was really exciting because you're thinking that at any moment, it could be one training session that turns everything around. As you know, Ross Jenkins went over to the first team in pre-season as a second-year scholar and didn't come back. You know, and we saw that and thought, wow, this is so inspiring for us as a group to think this could be us at any moment, literally any moment, and we could get a debut. That's all you want as a professional football player. Is you want to play football. You want to play at the highest level you possibly can. For me, I think if I was looking back, the advice I'd definitely give to myself would be to be more confident in myself and have more belief in what I can do. You know, some people may listen to that and say, well, I would have thought he was confident and maybe even had a bit of arrogance about him, but that is most certainly not the case. And, you know, even up until now, you know, I'm one of many, many people, I'm sure, in the world that suffer from imposter syndrome. And when you're doing okay, you sometimes question whether you should be in the position that you are. And so that's definitely a massive piece of advice I would have liked to have had at that time, is to continue just believing in myself and my abilities. And that's definitely a piece of advice I'd like to give to anybody listening as well.
It's good advice, and I think it's an important message about not assuming about how other people are, what they're made of, because I think there's too much of that these days, and in these difficult times, everyone needs to kind of stick together a little bit. So, Marvin, I think the best way to sum up what you're up to at the moment, check out your website. You're up to amazing work. You've done incredible work. I think we mentioned as Watford supporters, we were proud of you on the pitch. Well, that continues to be the case. The work you do, it's visible. We see it and we know it makes a difference. So we're still proud of you. So keep up that amazing work. What are you up to sort of in the next couple of weeks, months, years?
I am filming a short film in collaboration with Joe Media and the charity Calm. That'll be out in February, beginning of February, I think.
Awesome.
And then also mini-series that we co-produce with Yahoo, which hopefully will be out this month or the start of next month. That's been pushed back a lot, so I don't even know when that's going to be out, to be honest.
We'll keep our eyes peeled. Marvin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
From the Rookery End, a podcast about life following Watford FC.
Well, Michael, he has changed from the man that we spoke to, I don't know, when he played for Bolton many years ago, when he used to share pictures of his dinner. And the movies he used to watch on Twitter. It's actually remarkable, but it's such an uplifting, you know, to hear him speak the way he speaks about the things he speaks about is, as you said beforehand, it's inspiring.
Hugely impressive. And I think the reason he speaks like that is because he's confident in what he's talking about, because he understands it. And the reason he understands it is that he's lived it. And I'd say again, what he recognised while he was going through it, that other people would be going through it, and therefore that if he could talk about it, he could help other people. And I think it was really noticeable when he mentioned recognising traits in other footballers that he knew he went through as well, as little warning signs that they might be struggling. So just the way that, you know, he's younger than me and speaks far more articulately and impressively than I do. It's inspirational. It's a word we keep using, but I was in awe of him and I remain in awe of him. People who are able to find their voice and to use it for the greater good, now more than any other time, perhaps, when the world is so divisive, when it's so binary, whether it's so you're either on that side or the other side, you either agree with me or you're against me. For him to be so considered, yet so confident and assured, it's just really, really wonderful to hear. And it all comes from, I think, wanting to do good, wanting to help people, wanting to use his experiences to help others and to make other people understand. Perhaps they might not be going through a tough situation, but to perhaps make them understand that other people might be, and how they can recognise that and help it. And one of the big things that came out of it is, I do think at this time, we do reference it from time to time, We are going through difficult times in this world at the moment, whether it's politics, whether it's health, whether it's football and Watford not doing great. We haven't got much to cling on to at the moment, and it can be tough. And I think Marvin's point about reminding us that football players are just blokes, chaps, youngsters, trying to do their best, human beings, and perhaps we need to be a little bit kinder to them, just like we need to be a little bit kinder to each other. And I think if there's anything that I take away from, well, I take away a lot from the chat, but take a beat, take a breath, just think about the reality of the situation, of the world, of life, before perhaps going in two-footed on a particular issue or a particular player. And I finished that call with Marvin feeling, you know, empowered, feeling like a better person, feeling like I have a better outlook on life, really. So it was a pleasure to talk to him. I'm hugely grateful for him giving up his time. He gave up a lot more time, I suspect, than he had planned to at the start. Me, go on. Who'd have thought it? Eh? at this time, with the world the way it is, with Watford the way they are, I thought it was hugely, hugely timely. And what a guy.
And the club sort of aware of these different times and put out a lot of services or restructured a few services this week. If anything is going wrong and the club can help you, not just with being a Watford supporter, there's the @WatfordFCHelp on Twitter. A phone number you can call, which is 01923-223023. Or the email for anything, any help, any inquiries that you have for the club. It's supporters@watfordfc.com. They're doing their thing. And, you know, we're not the club and we're not anything massive like that. You know, we are, our DMs are open. And if we can help you in any way, then do get in touch with us.
Let's not underestimate that, what the club's doing. I think the Hornets at Home initiative is absolutely fantastic. It started during the first lockdown and they've brought it back full time. And I think that just shows, you know, it was the Scars for GT day at the Huddersfield game. And the fact that Watford continue to look out for their community, and they recognised it during the first lockdown, but have now realised that that's something they can do, you know, full time, really, not just during lockdown. And, you know, all the details are on the website if you check it out. But basically, if you feel like you're struggling, or if you feel like someone and you know is struggling and could use a pick me up, get in touch with the club. They will call you back and talk about it and work out the best way of how they can help. They can't solve everything, but what they can do is a little nudge here and there, and they can help out. And the fact that they have that roadmap to make that happen and to make it so easy, I think is testament to the brilliant people at our brilliant club who work there. They have the club at their heart, and you can say all you want about transfer activity and about being offside too many times. Ultimately, it's that club, it's the badge that we love, and the people there that make sure that Watford remains entrenched and committed to the community, like all that work that Elton John and GT did and people before them, to make sure that lives on. I cannot speak highly enough of the efforts they do to bring that to fruition. It can get overlooked easily because football is more exciting than former players phoning someone. It is. But the fact that that happens, it could make all the difference to an individual. And the fact that Watford put the structure in place to make it happen, I'm so proud of it and so glad to see it. You know, they've opened the doors to the NHS Trust again. They didn't make a big song and dance over that, but the NHS did, and the Inter Vicarage Road. That's what a football club is about. That's why we give up our time happily to talk about it on the podcast. That's why so many other people do so many things about Watford. There is so much to be proud of. They are working so hard. And if you need it, take advantage of it. Use it. That's what they're there for. It's a football club with roots in the community. We are the community. And like John said, if any of us can ever be of any use, if it's a DM, if it's whatever, then just reach out. As Marvin said, as I said after my chat with Marvin, let's be good to each other and we can get through it. And let's be good to each other and we can get through it.
We certainly can. And we'll get through another game on Tuesday in Watford, play at home to Barnsley. Thank you very much, Michael.
No problem. A massive thanks to Marvin, and thank you to everyone that listens as well. We continue to get lovely feedback, and we try and tweet back as often as possible. But it means a lot. You know, we've talked about how cathartic it is for us to talk Watford after a game. It really, really is. It helps. But the thought that people are listening and enjoying it makes us feel all warm and fuzzy inside. We really, really appreciate it. So thank you so much.
And thank you to Jason. And it was a bit of a different day at Vicarage Road. We weren't all able to be there to celebrate Graham Taylor and everything that he gave to this club 4 years on after his death. But Mike was there, and this is what the 72nd minute of the game sounded like at Vicarage Road today. There is only one Graham Taylor.